Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
We'll be looking back at all the action from last night, that dramatic late winner from Christian Eriksen, but also a much less late goal from Shane Long. He scored the fastest goal in Premier League history, only for Andre Gray to grab a late, late equaliser for Watford and ensure that they managed a point at Vicarage Road. Let's talk to Andy Lewis from the Hornets Net podcast about this. Andy, I mean, when you get a late equaliser, it always feels like a point gained, but was this 2 points dropped?
It's difficult, really. I think in the grand scheme of things, looking, if you'd said 1-1 before the game started, I definitely would have classed it as 2 points dropped. But I think the way Southampton set up, obviously with that early goal, I think we have to look at it as a point gained. I thought Southampton were the better side, certainly throughout the first half. Watford were much better in the second, but Southampton looked really organised. It was a really good away performance from them. Obviously, nearly came out with a perfect away display. So it has to be seen as a point gained. Managed to climb up into seventh, and Europa League still just about within our hands.
I mean, I imagine that Europa League football, much as it does seem to hamper some teams' season, that would still be a bit of a dream for Watford fans, would it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I would take having a not great season next season if it means we qualify for Europe this season. To be honest, I think we've got enough to have a relatively comfortable season next year. We would obviously be a bit more active in the transfer window. Unlike Burnley, I think we're in a better place to do that. But yeah, I mean, last time we were in Europe was 1983-84. So it's been a long time coming. I've not experienced Watford in Europe, and so that for me and for, you know, other fans of my age, my generation, would be a dream come true.
You mentioned the transfer window over the summer, that the man that, I think it's died down a little bit now, but initially Abdoulaye Doucouré looked almost certain to be going to PSG. Maybe that's the tabloid media for you, but do you think you'll hang on to him this summer? And similarly, Gerard Deulofeu, another guy who's really impressed. You think those two will be tough to hang on to? Can you do it?
I think it all depends on if we qualify for Europe, personally. I mean, we were all prepared as fans for Doucouré to be off last summer. Thankfully, we managed to squeeze another contract out of him. But I think if we're not to qualify for Europe and an offer comes in, I think we cash in this time round. However, if we do qualify, I would love to see them both stay and just, you know, stick it out and maybe get another season out of them and try and see how far they can get Watford in Europe. But so we'll have to see. But if they do go, then we'll get a fair bit of money for them. I don't think there'll be a Watford fan that begrudge them a move, because they both deserve to be playing for slightly bigger clubs. I think it's fair.
You mentioned that the big club thing and playing in Europe. Would you be quite happy as a Watford fan to be finishing 7th, 8th, 9th or 10th for the next couple of years? Or do you actually have aspirations that one day, with a little bit more money, you could break into that top six?
I think you've got to have that ambition. You know, there's no point being in the Premier League if you just want to sort of exist and just do the same thing year on year. You know, the last three seasons, it's pretty much been exactly the same for Watford. It's been mid-table obscurity and dying down towards the end of the season. But this year, we've finally seen that progress. And, you know, the owners don't want to stand still. We've seen it, you know, with some fairly big clubs, you know, West Brom, your Swansea's, your Stokes. They've all kind of just existed in the last few years and then ended up going back down. And the owners don't want to do that. We always want to have that ambition and push on. And, you know, the top six are there to be broken into. Look at Leicester a few seasons ago. It's not impossible. I think the gap between maybe your Arsenals, your Chelsea's, even, dare I say, Man United, between them and the best of the rest, your Everton's, Leicester's, Watford's, I think it's getting smaller. So there's every chance that one of those clubs, not just us, one of us could break into that big six next season.
Very quickly, Andy, because I know you're a man with very little time on your hands, but I've got to ask you about the FA Cup final. How much belief have you got that you can upset Manchester City?
I'm not 100% confident, obviously, but I personally don't see any point in any Watford fan going to Wembley if you don't believe Watford can win. You know, if you're going there just for the day out thinking you're going to lose, then, you know, give your ticket to someone else who's going to go with that belief. It's an FA Cup final. We deserve to be there. Look at how we pulled it back against Wolves in the semi-final. It's going to be an incredible day. And, you know, there is every chance that Watford can overturn Manchester City on May the 18th.
Andy, thanks so much for giving us the lowdown on Watford. That's Andy Lewis from the Hornet's Nest there. Well, Watford, of course, drawing 1-1 with Southampton last night. Shane Long broke the record for the fastest goal in Premier League history, 7.69 seconds.
Love Sport.
I think Christian have this capacity to create in a difficult moment, find a way to broke down the opponent. And Christian is an unbelievable player. And you always believe that this type of player like Christian can score.
That's Mauricio Pochettino there, Tottenham manager, talking about Christian Eriksen, whose late winner gave Spurs a crucial victory at the Tottenham Stadium last night in front of the Sud Tribune, the South Stand, whatever you want to call it. That 17,500, I was going to say all-seater stand, but no one was sitting down, so you can't really call it that. It's not safe. You're supposed to sit down at football matches. That's the safe way to do it. But anyway, well, maybe I'm just a stick in the mud. Who knows? But Christian Eriksen with a crucial goal last night, breaking Brighton hearts. You had to feel sorry for Chris Hughton's side. You could see it on their faces. They've got such a difficult run in. Newcastle at home and then Arsenal and Man City. You can't see them getting any points out of the last two games. All it does is heap the pressure on them this weekend. But yeah, Christian Eriksen, a fine finish. Remember, by the way, that he's only got 13 or 14 months left on his contract. Pochettino also said, and you didn't hear it in the clip there, but he also said, you know, there's time to talk over the summer. Now, these talks, I know, have been going on for about 8 months, and they've still not managed to get a deal done for Christian Eriksen. If Tottenham get to the beginning of next season and Eriksen hasn't signed a deal, that's it, I think, because they'll have to try and cash in on him at least a little bit. Daniel Levy obviously knows that he wants a little bit of money for him, but he also doesn't want to pay too much for him in terms of a new contract. Tottenham could find themselves in a little bit of trouble there. But I did want to point out a couple of things that you might have missed from Tottenham versus Brighton last night. I always try and watch football with three eyes. You know, two eyes watching the game and then one just looking for those weird moments. There was a particularly amusing, heartbreaking, passionate moment in the very latter stages. Brighton, I thought, they might have nicked a point. They really might. Solly March, skinned two players, cutting in from the right touchline, bearing down on the penalty area. Solly March is 24. He's South Coast born and raised. He's Brighton through and through. You cut him and he bleeds blue and white stripes. He saw the headlines to strike a famous blow in the race for Premier League survival. And he hit the side netting. Now you'd think, all right, well done, mate. Good effort. Not his captain. Lewis Dunk, in the middle of the penalty area, had broken free. He wanted the ball crossed. And when the ball hit the side netting, Lewis Dunk hit the roof. The Tottenham Stadium doesn't have a roof at the moment, but he would have hit it. He was going absolutely mental. He was punching the air, beating the turf. That's the kind of passion that we love football for. Lewis Dunk is another guy who is Brighton through and through. We'll speak to Dean Cox a little later on, who was a teammate of his, and he knows just how much that club means to that man. It was slightly heartbreaking to see, but it also made me think, God, I hope Brighton are here next year. That would be just great. But if they do go down, I wonder if Lewis Dunk might just remember that moment and think, Solly, remember when you didn't pass to me at Tottenham? I would have scored. I mean, he's a centre-half. He probably wouldn't have scored. In the crowd, there was also something to be noted on. I admit, I didn't immediately recognise Zac Efron at the Tottenham game last night when he popped up. Thank goodness Sky put a little box in the screen saying this is Zac Efron, an actor. Maybe it's because I've not seen High School Musical. Sorry, I know, surprise everyone, but I've not seen it. My producer Aaron is shaking his head pretending he's not seen it as well. I mean, I know he has, but he pretends he hasn't. But also the reason I didn't recognise him was because the last photo I saw of him, he'd lost about 2 stone in weight. His eyes were, you know, sticking out of his skull. He was dressed up as Ted Bundy for Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile. By the way, he actually looked like Ted Bundy in that film. He didn't look like Ted Bundy last night. He looks, I don't know, more like a sort of 90s pop star. He had all those muscles back, bleached blonde hair. I really didn't recognise him when he turned up in the posh seats at Tottenham. But, by the way, I thought there weren't any posh seats at Tottenham. That's kind of the whole point. They're all... No? Okay, turns out there are posh seats. And Zac Efron had one. He looked much better. But I did recognise him once I'd been pointed out exactly who he was. Talking to the bloke next to him with amazement at the beer glasses that fill up from the bottom. So it turns out, even if you're a massive Hollywood star, you're still amazed by a different way of pouring a pint. Despite all of that, Zac Efron was still not the most unlikely appearance at the Tottenham Stadium last night. Vincent Janssen, remember him? No, let me refresh your memory. He's about 6'4", he's a striker for Tottenham. Do you not remember him? Ah, that's probably because he hasn't played for Tottenham since August 2017. This is the man they signed from AZ Alkmaar for about 22 million quid in the hope that he would be the man to compete with Harry Kane for the place as Tottenham's number one striker. In the words of Mauricio Pochettino, he says Janssen ticked all the boxes that he needed. I don't really know what those boxes kind of said, except will not bother Harry Kane for competition too much, might not turn up for work all the time, is happy not to actually play football. Well, it tells you how desperate Mauricio Pochettino was last night that he actually brought him on. But there was a fabulous moment as he was getting prepared, chatting to the assistant coach about exactly what his role would be. And in the background, Eric Dier's on the bench. And he is, slapping his thighs with excitement. Honestly, he looks like a kid who's just been told they're going to Disneyland just because Vincent Janssen is actually going to get a few minutes of senior football. Maybe it was just the thought of seeing Tottenham's number 9. And yes, Vincent Janssen still wears the number 9 shirt, incredibly, back on the pitch. Needless to say, Janssen didn't score. He did have a chance, right? There was an Eriksen shot about 5 minutes from time that spilled to him. I thought, here it is. It's the moment. Vincent Janssen is going to become the most unlikely hero in history. He's not played for nearly 2 years, and he's going to score the goal that guarantees, or at least gets close to guaranteeing, Tottenham Champions League football next year. No. I mean, of course, fairy tales are fairy tales for a reason. It was never going to happen. The Dutchman fluffed his chance and will probably be never seen again. Honestly, the good thing about it was it made me think that if I grew an inch, I could play up front for Tottenham. Because honestly, if Vincent Janssen can do it, almost anyone can. I'm not in bad nick at the moment. I've scored a few goals in training for my five-a-side team when we don't play with an opponent and we do patterns of play. I've done it every now and again. So maybe I can play Champions League football as a striker. It's always nice to be told you can dream, isn't it? If Tottenham fans are dreaming of Champions League football next year, they'll be hoping that City beat Manchester United tonight, of course, in the Manchester derby. Manchester United fans will be hoping that City beat Manchester United because they don't want Liverpool to win the title. Chelsea will probably want United to slip up as well. There's not many people actually want United to win tonight, except Liverpool fans. This is an unusual situation for me. I don't like Manchester United at all. I never have, obviously. I grew up in the 80s and 90s. Why would I like Manchester United? They were good. They always have been good. But tonight, and it really pains me to say it, I will be cheering Manchester United with all my heart. And I hate every fibre of myself for it. I will love it if they win, and I will be torn in this sort of horrible classic post-coital guilt where I've got everything that I wanted and yet I still feel massively guilty for the way that I got it. There will be pubs in Liverpool decked out in red and black of Manchester United, desperately hoping that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer can pull off a 13-2 victory. And afterwards, they're all going to look at themselves and think, what have we become?
Love Sport.
This is Upfront with James Gray on Love Sport. I'm covering all the biggest stories in sport. Of course, looking back at last night's Premier League results, remember, Southampton broke the record for the fastest ever Premier League goal. I think they might also have broken a record for the most time leading in a game without winning, because Andre Gray scored an equaliser in the 90th minute, topping and tailing the 1-1 draw. And of course, Tottenham left it late as well. They needed a late Christian Eriksen goal to get 3 points at the Tottenham Stadium. But away from the pitch, off the pitch, the FA have been thinking about the FA Cup final. They think about the FA Cup final a lot, including moving the kickoff time, turning up different people, booking bands, all sorts of things, usually that don't involve football. Anyway, one of the things that they've thought about is the celebrations. The FA have said they will no longer, this is according to a story in the Mail today, they'll no longer award a case of champagne to the winners of the FA Cup. It's a long-held tradition which they will now abandon. Instead, they're going to use non-alcoholic champagne. Seems reasonable. Footballers aren't supposed to drink anyway. End of story. Yeah, no controversy there, is there? Apparently not. The story also mentions that they're doing it, quote, so as not to offend players whose religion forbids alcohol use. As you can imagine, The PC Gone Mad Brigade have latched onto this as yet another example of the Thought Police trying to control me. I know Twitter's a black hole for this stuff, but listen to some of these reactions, right? This is Phil CMJLL. Don't think it's his real name. Religion is the outdated thing in this story. It's a nice touch to leave champagne for the winning team. If someone doesn't want to drink it or spray it around, then fine. And then a smiley emoji. As usual, just basically a brain fart. We've also got something from Matt Kendrick 3 here. I don't know if the 3 is his mother's surname or... Oh, it's a handle. I see, okay. Scrap the bubbly. Scrap tackles or any contact whatsoever. Scrap bad or offensive language. Scrap football's offensive shape. Scrap red cards, scary colour. Scrap grass. Where does it stop? 2 question marks inexplicably spaced out. And then, finally, J. Schofield 93. Honestly, I don't know whether he was born in 93 or... I can't say what I want to say. I wonder if he just hatched in the sun in that year. Ridiculous. If you don't want to drink it, don't drink it. But why should the option be taken away from the players who do? Every institute in this country being run by PC melts. I don't know what a melt is. I regard it as cheese on top of a sandwich and then put under the grill for 2 to 3 minutes with some brown sauce. But apparently it means a moron, an idiot, some sort of softy. First of all, right, there's a couple of things I need to absolutely ruin these people for. And I really hope, if you disagree with me, call me on 0208 7020 558. Do you think players should be allowed to drink champagne after the FA Cup final? Tell me why and we'll have an argument. First of all, this isn't about being offended by other people drinking champagne. It's not as though they stand there and go, I'm so offended. It's not about offence, right? It's about the people whose religion forbids the stuff even touching their skin. So we're accommodating them, making a reasonable change by slightly tweaking what is realistically a slightly odd tradition. Why celebrate by spraying very expensive alcohol all over each other? It's bizarre, some sort of form of celebration. All we're doing is tweaking it and making it non-alcoholic. It doesn't fly out of the bottles with a big label on it saying, this is not alcohol, this is not a real celebration. It looks exactly the same to you sitting on your backside at home complaining about the fact that the PC police are, you know, having a pop at you for enjoying alcohol. This has come up before, by the way. I made a point on Twitter back in September that it was time for the England cricket team to give up their champagne after I saw them celebrating a series victory against South Africa. Moeen Ali and Adil Rashid were stood away to the side of the team celebration of a series victory. Both men are proud Muslims, and Moeen actually has said that he plays cricket and feels he represents Islam when he's playing. And to their credit, they've made very little fuss over this champagne thing. But it was a terrible look. Islam and cricket have such a strong association in this country because a lot of Muslims in this country have heritage in countries that have massive cricket traditions. And for 2 Muslim cricketers to be cowering at the side while the white lads went mental with champers was terrible to see. It really was. What sort of message does that send to a young Muslim lad growing up in Britain who dreams of playing cricket for England because it's the country he's always known? What it says to him is actually... you can be part of this society or this team, but only a little bit. You can't really be a proper part because you don't want alcohol to touch your skin. You melt. Honestly, what kind of a message would it send if Riyad Mahrez or Abdoulaye Doucouré or Benjamin Mendy had to stand to one side at this year's FA Cup final after winning it? That famous photo, the trophy in the air in the captain's hands, the fireworks going off behind them and the corks flying... wouldn't include the whole team. It's not the kind of look anyone wants. But a country which is very multicultural and where we want people to feel accepted for who they are. It's not as though we're going out of our way to make a massive change, by the way. It's a very minor change to make, to be a little bit more accepting of other people's cultures. What is so terrible about that? And if you want to sit on Twitter and say, what next? No grass because of the asthmatics, no mud for people who don't like getting dirty, no football for people who are scared of round things, fine. Sit on Twitter and shout into the ether about how much you hate the world. But know that you are everything that is wrong with the direction football is going in. You're the person who throws a punch at Jack Grealish because he's wearing a different colour shirt. You're the person who... sits in the front row and shouts the N-word and you think that it's your right to do so because you pay for a ticket and it's a free country, innit? You're the person who thinks that singing No Surrender in an England game is fine because you've always done it. What? The Aerotelis group? Not like I'm winding anyone up. You are, and you're an idiot. You know what? Not in my name. Not in my name as a football fan will I listen to you sit at home, tweet out your filth, your ignorant, bigoted filth. Understand that actually, multiculturalism is quite fun. Multiculturalism is how this country became great, because we have people from all over the world, from different cultures, different religions, and it makes the country exciting. If everyone had the same opinion on things, it wouldn't be interesting. If everyone did things the same way, life would get boring. Try and embrace, for one moment in your terrible little life, just try and embrace the fact that we've got different people in this country who enjoy doing different things, and embrace the fact that the one time they can come together sometimes is in sport, when they all put on the same colour shirt, play for the same goal and lift the same trophy. Who cares what they're spraying at each other?
Love Sport.
It was a case of oh so near and yet oh so far for Brighton last night as they went to the Tottenham Stadium and kept Spurs out for 88 minutes. But Christian Eriksen finally broke their resistance with a stunning late winner from outside the box. It was heartbreak for Brighton and they now face a tough task to ensure that they stay in the Premier League for next season. Let's speak to someone who knows Brighton better than most. It's Dean Cox, former Brighton winger and a Sussex lad through and through. Dean, it must have been really, really gutting to concede that late goal last night.
Yeah, I think they done terrifically well. I think the game plan was there for 86 minutes. I think they frustrated Tottenham throughout the game. Lewis Dunk had a fantastic game, marshalling the defence, and they were throwing the bodies on the line. And fortunate for us that, you know, Christian Eriksen's got that star quality, and obviously it was a fantastic strike Obviously gutting, because for 86 minutes, you know, it was a fantastic performance, and a point would have been a valuable one.
There was talk earlier. I mean, I know those two home defeats were very, very damaging for Brighton, obviously, 5-0 and 2-0 to Bournemouth and Cardiff. But I heard talk, a few people, not many admittedly, saying hooting out. That would have been madness at this late stage, wouldn't it?
Sorry, I didn't for to sack the manager?
Yeah,
that?
Yeah. I mean...
Oh, absolutely. No, that'd be ludicrous. Absolutely, yeah, bonkers. He's done a fantastic job since he's been there. You know, they're just hitting a bad patch of form, and I think, you know, any manager in the same situation, they've gone back to basics, which is the sensible thing to do. You know, they do try and play expansive at the Amex, but, you know, those two games that you mentioned, obviously we come unstuck, and you know, we were leaking goals left, right and centre. So I think he's gone back to basics and steadied the ship. Obviously, the Saturday versus Newcastle, they're going to have to be a bit more expansive because we need goals. But for those games that I said, you know, the way he wanted to play was for me spot on. And obviously, Newcastle Saturday, yeah, I'm sure he'll ring the changes again because Glenn Murray got a rest. I foresee them going back into the starting lineup. I think they'll really go for Newcastle.
You mentioned Lewis Dunk there. He was impressive last night again. You know, he has been. He's won an England cap last year and everything. I think you must have overlapped with him a little bit at Brighton. Was he the kind of guy who, when he was a bit younger, you looked at and thought, yeah, he could actually really be something?
Do you know what? He wasn't.
Really?
I've got to be honest. I think he was a late developer.
Yeah.
When I was in the youth team there, he was a late developer. But the year just before I left, he was coming into his own. And I think the main thing with Lewis is that he can play out from the back. He's, you know, he's a footballer as well as a defender, so he can start attacks. You know, with his passes into midfield, his calmness and his range of passing with the diagonal passes with left and right foot that I've seen this season has been really impressive. And he's earned his England call up. He earned his improved contract at Brighton, and definitely should be captain because Brighton through and through, and I mean, you saw last night how much it means to him. You know, he was throwing his body on the line, you know, head everywhere, sticking his head in, kicking. You know, he was really up for it. And like I said, for 86 minutes, him and the team were fantastic. But that extra bit of quality from Christian Eriksen just, you know, decided the game.
Do you worry that if the worst does happen and Brighton end up going down, someone like Lewis Dunk, you know, as you say, he's a guy who can play with his feet and his head, that some of the big clubs might look at him and go, yeah, I think we'll have that?
Oh, I think so. I think that's only natural, isn't it? I mean, as a Brighton fan, I'm not even considering going down. I do think they beat Newcastle on Saturday, and I think we will be okay. But, yeah, I think if worst case scenario, if that was to happen, I think Lewis is going to want to stay in the Premier League. He's a proven Premier League player, in my opinion, to play higher. But why leave? You're captain of your hometown club. He plays every week. He's playing really well. He's got his England call-up, but obviously, like you say, if they were to drop into the Championship, perhaps Lewis' mindset may change and he may want to leave. But you never know. He's been very loyal. He may stay. I mean, that is Lewis's decision. But definitely Premier League clubs would definitely be all over him if Brighton were to be relegated.
Funnily enough, one of the clubs I was thinking of that Brighton have to play on May the 5th when they head to Arsenal. You mentioned you think they'll beat Newcastle. Will that be enough? That'll put them on 37 points. Do you see Cardiff catching them, or actually do they not need to worry about trying to get a point out of Arsenal City?
No, I think if Cardiff don't beat Fulham this Saturday, I find it hard to see them picking up points. In my opinion. But I think, Brighton have just got to look after themselves. I mean, like you said, I do think we'll beat Newcastle. And if they can perform like they did at Tottenham last night at Arsenal, they could nick a point there and then that would be mathematically safe. So I do think that, there's been a lot of hype and people are obviously concerned because, the run of results haven't been great. But, I still think with the point at Wolves and the performance last night, you've got to take the positives. And I'm sure Chris and his backroom staff are definitely, feeling the same. The players look together. So I'm confident that they're going to beat Newcastle on Saturday. And whatever is required to stay up, I do believe they stay up. And I think Cardiff will go down.
I do have a lot of time for Chris Hughton, and I do hope Brighton stay up. If they do, how much work do you think they need to do over the summer to ensure that next year isn't another close relegation battle?
I think there's a lot. I think there's been... what's the word? I think they need to look at their recruitment. I do think, they've relied on Glenn Murray. And I've played with Glenn, and he's not getting any older. He's probably he's not getting any younger. He's not going to thank me for that. But at 35, we're dependent on him. And listen, that's all credit to Glenn. He's been fantastic this season for his age to be doing what he's doing. And without his goals, I mean, it'd be scary to know where we would actually be. But he's been fantastic. But I do think we need a striker. I do think we need... I think we need at least three or four, but I mean proper Premier League players. I know, they seem to go abroad. I think the ones that have come in haven't materialised as maybe perhaps they would like. So I think they definitely need more firepower, that's for sure. I think the defence is great. I think that's fine. I think, will Bruno stay? I don't know. Obviously, again, he's getting on. Duncan Duffy, obviously, fantastic two centre-half. So, Bernardo, I thought, played quite well last night as well. So, perhaps they may need a right-back. But I think firepower is quite clear. Goals have been, not a lot to come by recently. So, definitely firepower.
And it's what everyone wants. Everyone always wants a striker, especially down the bottom end of the table. Dean, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on. Great to have someone who knows Brighton through and through on the show. That's Dean Cox, former Brighton player, a man who spent a long, long time at the club and also didn't think Lewis Dunk was that much coming up. Well, he's that much now.
Love sport.
Because as you all know, I am required by the station, for reasons which are completely beyond me, to do a prediction segment. They like to basically make me look like an idiot, because I'm not Nostradamus. I don't always know what's going to happen in the Premier League. Let's have a listen to what I said about last night's clash between Spurs and Brighton. I think this is pretty easy, actually. I think it's very straightforward. Brighton have been absolutely dreadful recently. Two very poor home defeats to nil. I know they're going away to Tottenham. They can set up in a slightly different way. But no matter what Chris Hughton's managed, I don't think he's going to turn it around. I think Tottenham will win 2-0. I think it'll be relatively comfortable. Yeah, it's a correct result. I mean, it wasn't relatively comfortable, although Brighton did offer very little. Once again, they failed to score. So I'm going to take You can only give me 1 point because I only got one correct result. But I'm going to take some personal credit for that, that I got vaguely close. I'm not convinced I got that close with this next game, which is Watford-Southampton. Well, this is a nightmare, isn't it? I mean, honestly, how am I supposed to pick this game? Watford, it's not even on telly, is it? No one wants to watch it. No one wants to predict it. Although Southampton won't fill them with confidence because they haven't beaten Southampton at home since 2007. And that was in the second tier of English football. They drew earlier in the season when they faced off. But I do think Watford are a better team now than they were then. I just think there's something about Watford at the moment. I think they might squeeze a 1-0 win. Oh, I was close, though. Come on, I was only one goal away, and I knew it'd be tight. And I almost talked myself into the draw as well. And, you know, it was 1-1 when they played down at St Mary's as well, so I'm kind of annoyed that I didn't work that one out. Very disappointing. I don't like that noise either. Can you change that noise? I don't like hearing it. It hurts my head. It hurts my ears. Let's just move on to the final game I had to predict last night, Luton versus Wimbledon. At Luton, Mick Harford's side, flying towards the League One title, you would have thought. Look, Wally Downes has pulled off some absolute miracles, and I don't think I overused that word in this particular case. When he went to Wimbledon, they were as good as relegated, and they've pulled off some really remarkable results. Remember that a win tonight would take them from 22nd to 18th in the table, assuming that Accrington Stanley don't get anything against Doncaster. That would, I think, probably keep them safe. I think that would be enough. It would take them to 48 points. I think that might just be enough. I think they'll pick up a couple more on their run-in anyway. I don't think they'll win because Luton are just too good. I think they might get a point. I'll go 1-1. 1-1. Maybe Joe Piggott will get another goal for Wimbledon. He's on fire at the moment. Get in! And Joe Piggott scored. I know I didn't get the score right, but that's pretty Nostradamic. They say I can't predict the future. Well, frankly, I've almost predicted the future there. I'm pretty pleased with that. Joe Piggott did score. It was Steve. He actually almost scored at the equaliser, but it was saved. And he was Seddon to nod it in following up in the third minute of stoppage time to grab Wimbledon a crucial point. They might not stay up. They got Wickham at home on Saturday. And then on the final day, they travel to relegated Bradford. We'll just have to see. Chris Drapers of the 9 Years podcast joined us earlier. He didn't seem optimistic, but I have faith in Wally Downes and his men. Let's move on to tonight, just the two Premier League fixtures. The first is the 7:45 kickoff at Molineux. It's Wolves versus Arsenal. It's a tricky little matchup, isn't it? You never quite know what to expect from Arsenal at the moment, other than they will not play well. They obviously don't like those physical encounters. And I suppose with Wolves, you know you're going to get quite a fast-paced, quite a physical encounter. Wolves haven't beaten Arsenal, by the way, since 1979, which is absolutely staggering. But Wolves did go to the Emirates and get a point earlier in the season. In fact, Arsenal nearly lost. They only equalised with about 5 minutes ago, Henrik Mkhitaryan. It was the first time, in fact, that Wolves had ever even taken the lead in a Premier League game against Arsenal in that particular fixture. But I think this one might buck the trend. I think Wolves will lead for a large part of this game, but I can see Arsenal getting a late equaliser. Somehow, they've got enough attacking talent that it might not work. Wolves have got a terrific record against top six sides. I think it'll be 1-1. I can see Wolves taking the lead, but I can just see Arsenal having enough quality going forward to just about find a way to get a point. It'll be more drop points, though. I've been looking at this Arsenal running for a while, and these away games all look difficult for them. I don't think Wolves will be any different. I'm going to go 1-1. Which leads me on to the biggest game of the night, of course. Probably the biggest game of the season so far, with everything that's riding on it. It's Manchester United versus Manchester City. Obviously, I'm desperate for United to win this game. And I don't like feeling like that. I'm a Liverpool fan through and through, and I don't like feeling like I want Manchester United to win. It's unnatural. It's weird. It's just, even the United fans, some of them don't want to win. I mean, we'll ask John Macken in a few minutes, who played for Manchester City but started at Manchester United, exactly what this game means and how much it means for United fans not to actually want to win it. I think my head is going to rule my heart on this one. I really want United to get something out of it. I'd love it. In the words of Kevin Keegan, I'd love it. They've got to go. I'd love it if we beat them. but I really just don't think. I think City will be excellent. When they've really needed to win this year, they've pulled it out of the bag. I think City will win 2-0. I absolutely hate it. We'll be asking John Macken what he thinks the score will be next.
Love Sports.
I saw the game, in fact, what they do. Imagine a little bit what is going to happen against us, and that's all. It's a different game. The game Everton is over, it's finished, and new one.
Now, of course, that's Pep Guardiola saying that he thinks Manchester United will be a threat. I mean, you just have to say that. You are kind of required as a manager before almost any game to say that your opponents are still dangerous. Are United dangerous? Sure, they carry some sort of threat. But are they actually going to cause Manchester City an upset? I just don't see it happening. When you consider, especially when you consider that result on Sunday, how poor United were. That wasn't deliberate. It wasn't as though they went out and thought Everton were going to be a soft touch and they could cruise past them. I think just that's the type of team they are at the moment. They've got a few players who, for whatever reason, don't turn up every week. They've got some inconsistency to them. Let's speak to someone who knows all about the Manchester derby. A man who scored in one, in fact. It's John Macken, former Manchester City player, on the line. John, why don't we talk about that day? Because I believe you scored in a 4-1 win over United, didn't you?
I did, yeah. It was the first derby in the new stadium, I got the second one. So it was a good day all round, really.
Yeah, I bet it was. That sounds like the understatement of the century. as a City player especially, I imagine, and while the tables have turned a little bit now, I imagine then that the idea of taking on United, that was your biggest game of the season, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, with the derbies are always big. You know, Manchester derbies are always big, big occasions for everybody involved, the players, the, you know, the fans, the clubs. And it was one of them occasions. Obviously, it was the first one, like I said, in the new stadium. So it was a big occasion because of that. And we wanted to, you know, we wanted to do well. And obviously, to get the 4-1 win as well, it was a big, big achievement, you know, for City at the time.
I wonder, we've heard this week that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been taking United players back to the cliff to try and teach them some of the history of the club and to get them up for it. I mean, that is pretty surprising to me that he feels the squad need getting up for it. Surely they'll be aware of how big this game is.
Well, you know, I find that bizarre myself. If you have to, you know, the history of Manchester United, if you have to go back to, you know, where they used to train, the cliff, where, you know, it's something wrong, I would say, you know, and the professional football players at the end of the day, so you should know every game's important, and, you know, derby ones as well, it gives it that little bit of extra spice, but, you know, at the end of the day, the professional football players, and they should be up for every single football match that they play in, you know, every day in training as well, so I find that a little bit worrisome for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, if he's feeling as though he's got to do that as a manager.
Well, I suppose he would be worried as well after the performance, and I use the word performance loosely there, they put in against Everton because they barely turned up. I don't think I've ever seen a team who are as inconsistent as this. I never really know what to put it down to. Is there anything in particular you think that seems to be affecting them?
I don't know. You know, they went on a great run when he first came in, and then he just seems to have dropped away totally at the moment. And it's, you know, obviously they had the good result against Paris Saint-Germain. But it was just a case of, you know, after that, they haven't performed at all. It looks like they're struggling for a little bit of confidence, which, once again, you know, I can understand, because obviously when you're not performing to your ability that warrants, you lack a little bit, and you need a little bit of luck, I suppose, at certain times for them. But I just think I just find it a bit bizarre how, you know, they can change so drastically, from, you know, doing well and full of confidence, and, you know, they're looking as though they want to progress and get in the top four to where they are now, you know, where it's doom and gloom. And like you just said, you know, the performance against Everton, it was woeful at that. You know, it just looked like there was no care there, and they just didn't turn up.
You've obviously played at all different levels of the Football League. You know, you've played just a lot of different clubs. You must have been in teams who've been on those losing runs. What is it like as a player coming into training when you have lost 6 of the last 8, or when you have just put in a performance like that on a Sunday? Does it vary team to team whether you have a really tasty training session or whether actually everyone's a bit down?
Well, I suppose you know you're down, but the next day, you're just working towards the next game, where you want to put things right. And, you know, in football, it's a funny old game that can change at any moment. It can change in the training session when you just feel something, you know, a bit of a buzz around the place again. But, you know, fortunately, when I was at City, we went on a run where I don't think we won for 18 games. So, you just keep going and you keep believing, and then you find something extra and it kicks you on again. I just find it, you know, I've always been lucky that I've always had big characters around, you know, when I've been playing, and obviously later on in my career, I tried to take that, all that, I suppose, experience on to help other people when we was fighting relegation in certain teams that I was in and so forth. And you just, you keep pushing. You have that little bit of extra belief about yourself that, you are going to turn a corner and you are going to keep everyone going and keep on a level where you know you're going to get 110% week in, week out on every training session and every game coming up. So I've been looking. I just think they're lacking a little bit of that leadership maybe at, you know, Manchester United at the moment.
The million-dollar question that we've all been asking today is, who would you rather win the title, Liverpool or Man City? I know what your answer will be, John, but yeah, I imagine you must know a lot of Manchester United fans who are sitting at home tonight thinking, oh, well, if we lose, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
Totally. You know, I think a lot of United fans have rolled the season off anyway, you know, so it's they're looking to next season. So I think with that in mind, they're thinking, well, you know, Man City winning the league is, you know, it's a lot better for them, or the way they look at it in terms of, you know, than Liverpool winning it. So, I obviously want City to win tonight, and I do believe they will win tonight. I think they'll win. Listen, derbies are always difficult to predict because it's a derby game and, you know, certain things can happen. But I do think City, you know, they've been massively up for the game. They've got something, you know, that they're fighting for with the treble. You know, they can still go for that. So they're looking to try and achieve something. And obviously winning the league is a massive achievement for them. You know, it's been a great league, to be fair. Again, once again, Liverpool are taking them all the way. But I just think City will have a little bit too much for United tonight.
Just finally, you mentioned you think City will win, but they will have to do it without Kevin De Bruyne. You know, how sad is it to see a player of his quality struggle with injury the way he has this season?
Yeah, he has. I mean, he struggled, but, you know, unfortunately, you know, he's at the top of his game and he's, you know, he trains to his maximum all the time and to a certain level that he's, you know, unfortunately this season it's took its toll on his body a little bit. And, you know, I was one of the same, you know, I later on in my career, I suffered quite a lot of injuries, you know, similar injuries with calves and hamstrings to do with your back. So I do know it's painful and it hurts you when you're not in the team and you want to go and play in these big games and, you know, win trophy. Well, I'm sure he'll be involved with the back end of it anyway. But, you know, you want to be involved in every single game. And he's going to be a big miss. But the quality that Man City have got in their squad, it's phenomenal, you know. And I'm sure somebody would be jumping at the bit to step in and show what they're about as well.
John, thank you so much for joining us and giving us that insight into the Manchester derby tonight. That's former Manchester City forward John Macken.
Love Sport.
Now, it would be easy to think there is only one game going on in the Premier League tonight because Manchester United are taking on Man City, the Manchester derby with massive implications for the Premier League title race. But there is also a mid-table clash going on between Wolves and Arsenal. That mid-table moniker has got Love Sport's very own Mike Stavrou, who's one of our tamed Arsenal fans, shaking his head. Sorry, Mike, you're going to have to start realising that Arsenal are not a top four side anymore.
Mid-table?
Well, you're pushing that. You're pushing that way.
Come on, James.
Well, honestly, if you look at the squad, right, and the performances and the results, other than that you're fine, but when you look at the squad, the performances and the results, it's a mid-table side. You were shocking at the weekend.
The squad has so struggled big time, and I think a lot of surgery needs to be done. I mean, when you're starting a midfield duo of Mohamed Elneny and Matteo Guendouzi, your 19-year-old, I mean, just purely hair wise I mean, you're struggling on that front.
Yeah, your barbers are not getting a lot of work at the moment.
How do you even see? Like, when you're running around with that mop of hair, how do you see in front of you?
I'm not convinced Mohamed Elneny can see, to be perfectly honest. It wouldn't surprise me. If
he would have a zero vision stat in FIFA. Mm. I think. But I mean, that midfield just screams lack of options. And I never thought I'd be saying this, but I think one of Arsenal's most important players is Granit Xhaka. And that's shown how much Arsenal have missed him, because he controls the tempo of the game, and there's no one in the squad currently that can do that. He makes everyone that's next to him look better, and when we're without him, we struggle to get a foothold on the game.
You know what's mental? I was talking to someone the other day, relatively reliable, and they say that Arsenal are willing to listen to offers for Matteo Guendouzi. Like, that is mad. I know there's a lot of dead wood to cut away in that Arsenal squad, but I thought Guendouzi was the few blokes. He looks like he's got a bit of stones in the middle.
Well, he does, James, but the thing is, when you rely on someone like that who's only 19, 20, I mean, you're going to struggle, because that's when players burn out. When they're that young and you say you have to play, what, 25 games a season? That's quite a lot to put on a young man's shoulders. And actually, I think he's kind of regressed a little bit, because he came in and he was all guns blazing and he kind of like set the world alight in terms of Arsenal youngsters, which we haven't. He was a scout. He was a scout, actually, scouted by Sven Mislintat, who...
Oh, really?
Who Diamond Eye, they call him.
Diamond Eye. Really?
Yeah, that's what they call him.
And he's the guy you've let go, right?
Yeah, and we've let him go because he scouted the likes of Kagawa, Aubameyang, I think Lewandowski as well. He saw even before Bayern, probably. I mean, all these players that came through at Bayern, and you know, you got someone like that, and then they get rid of it. The name that I've been seeing floated about is Edu for the technical director role.
Who's not been linked with the technical director at Arsenal? Honestly,
any player in the Invincibles. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if you see Loren in there for the technical director at Arsenal.
Let's not rule it out, honestly. No. How much work do Arsenal need to do this summer? I mean, I'm thinking probably. I mean, I know Unai Emery wants a left back. He wants a central midfielder. He wants another wide forward and another striker to replace Danny Welbeck.
And a centre back.
Mike, how many centre backs? How many centre backs does he need? Does he need to sign?
Well, I think we've got six in the squad. if you include Callum Chambers coming back, who hasn't played in centre back, but that's six.
You saw Callum Chambers play at centre half at Fulham, right? It was awful. He's all right at centre mid.
There's so much dead wood to get rid of, James. The worrying thing, you know, these reports keep coming out all the time. The latest one I saw from Metro this morning was that Arsenal will have a £40 million budget in the summer if they don't finish in the Champions League. If we do get into the Champions League next season, it will go up to £75 million. I mean, you're still not playing with a lot there, considering Liverpool spent that on one centre-back. So you're going to be shopping in the mid-market. So there's a lot of surgery. And you think, right, if they've got such a low budget, especially if they don't finish in the Champions League, next season, you'd want someone like Sven Mislintat who can pick out hidden gems, like Matteo Guendouzi, who can come in and do a job. But they've got rid of him, so it's bizarre.
I just don't see how Arsenal are expecting to be competing.
It's dire. It's so bad.
Let's talk about tonight. Heading up to Molineux, Wolves have got a great record against top six sides. You nicked a point off them when they came to the Emirates. Have you got any chance? I mean, every Arsenal fan I've spoken to so far seems to think, nah, no way.
I mean, the fact that Emery said in his midweek press conference that he'd be happy with a draw, I think that tells you about what they're going to go into the game with. Wolves, they only have one way to play against the big teams, and counter-attack.
Mm.
So I think if Arsenal go with a different approach...
They counter the counter-attack by counter-attacking.
Counter the counter-attack by counter-attacking. I think that's
sounds
the way
like
to
it's
go.
Going to be a classic, Mike.
We've lost four of our seven away games against the sides in the top half currently. So not looking too great, but... I think they have to be up for it, James. They have to.
There's nothing to suggest other than that win in Napoli. But as you said to me earlier, Napoli were dreadful in that game. Other than that game, there is no reason to suggest that Arsenal, who are, by the way, the ninth best team in the Premier League away from home, they've only got six wins on the road this season. There's no reason to suggest they'll be up for it today as they were on any other game.
I mean, if you're looking at the last few results, I mean, Napoli home and away were good performances. Crystal Palace, they had to rest players. I mean, when you're playing three games in 6 days, one of which is an away trip in Naples, I mean, the squad obviously isn't good enough. And that was a tired display from Arsenal on the weekend against Palace. So they know that they need to win because, to be fair, we were done a bit of a favour with just how poor the rest of the top four challengers did.
Mm.
Spurs lost, United lost, Chelsea drew against Burnley. So they've kind of been afforded a bit of space to mess up. So tonight is where they really need to go. I mean, a draw will do because it will put us level on points with Chelsea. But there's still tough games to come. We've still got to play Leicester away on Saturday. Still got Brighton. So, yeah, we'll see.
Mind the gap to Tottenham, eh? You'll close them down one day, Mike. You'll overtake Tottenham one day, I'm sure. But this season probably isn't going to be it. Mike Staver, our tamed Arsenal fan. I hope the lineup tonight is good enough for you to actually bother watching it.
Love Sport.
Counting down, of course, to this massive Manchester derby tonight. Now, as a Liverpool fan, and I've just seen Jamie Carragher wearing a Manchester United shirt, I know how he feels. I won't do that. I won't put on a Manchester United shirt. I'm morally against it. But for tonight, I am hoping that United might just come out victors, or at least get a draw. That'd be fine too. And it was interesting because Paddy Power did a poll yesterday. They asked fans who they would rather win the league, Liverpool or Manchester City. There were some unsurprising results. 100% of Liverpool fans want Liverpool to win the league. Funny that. 100% of Man City fans want Man City to win the league. You have to wonder why those fans bothered taking part. It seems bizarre. But there were a few other more interesting results. 75% of Fulham fans would rather Liverpool win the league. Judging by the crowd at Craven Cottage last time Klopp came to town, they're all Liverpool fans anyway. So that doesn't surprise me either. But I was really, really surprised that so many United fans, 64% in fact, said they would rather see City win the title than Liverpool. That's 2 in 3. Is that really how far United have fallen? That they can't even dream of competing with Man City? They can't even bring themselves to want to stop their closest rivals, who for so long were the second team in Manchester? Instead, they have to resort to trying to torment a side who haven't won a title in 3 decades. I think it's a sign of decay, frankly, at United, and it's a sign of how far they've fallen. Another sign of it is that United are it's the price you can get them at tonight. They're 13-2 to win against City. According to Odds Monkey, that's the biggest price they have ever been to win a match at Old Trafford. So in an effort to deal with it, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has tried rolling back the years. The baby-faced assassin has taken the players back to the old training ground at the Cliff in an effort to remind them, maybe spark in them, some of the passion that the history of this derby is supposed to. And he's even adopted some Sir Alex Ferguson tactics in press conferences. You may have heard him say of City yesterday, "They will snap at your ankles and heels and kick you. There will be fouls, no doubt about it. They commit so many players forward and will be stopping us as high as they can." It's straight out of Fergie's playbook. It's an absolute classic. Alert the referee to something you think might just swing the game in your favour. City, by the way, don't commit that many fouls. Really as many as any other side in the Premier League. But it's not actually, and Solskjaer's kind of right in this sense, it's not about the number of fouls. It's about the specific nature of those fouls. High up the pitch, frustrating the counter-attacks, which are United's, frankly, best hopes. Because there's no way United are going to have much of the ball here, are they? They're going to be counter-attacking. It reminds me of when Arsene Wenger first came to England. And Peter Walton, actually, who's a former referee, now writes an excellent column for The Times, he was recalling that Wenger addressed referees as a whole about how his pass-and-move football was vulnerable to team fouling, i.e. a tactic where players take turns breaking up play in the middle illegally. And by taking turns, they avoid the repeated fouling yellow card. Referees can still book players for team fouling as a whole, but it's obviously much, much harder to do. Now, what's funny is very rarely, because Pep Guardiola has been in battles with all sorts of managers, he's been wound up by the best, but very rarely does he get riled by these sorts of accusations. But he seemed legitimately stunned and staggered when someone put Solskjaer's comments to him, and I think his temper might just have been piqued by Solskjaer. It is, incidentally, about as angry as Guardiola gets in press conferences. I think he was genuinely annoyed by the accusation that they might foul too much or foul more in the Manchester derby tonight. I also wonder whether it's true. I think it probably is, because if you do commit a lot of men forward and you do commit a foul, you know, in that final third because you think they're about to break away, it's slightly different from committing a foul in your own half. You don't tend to get penalised as badly, you're less likely to get booked, and also it's a much less dangerous free kick position. So very interesting. I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is starting to get into his head. The old mind games are back. Even if Manchester United's team are not, their form is not, their trophies are not, the old tiffs between United and City managers die hard. Maybe the fans could learn a thing or two about that. Don't pretend you want your team to lose just so that Liverpool don't win the title. The reality is, you want your team to win the derby, but you know that they can't. So why not maybe just get behind the Manchester rivalry? You're still going to have to sit next to Dave at work on Thursday, and he's still going to tell you how much better City are than you if you lose tonight. So maybe get behind your team and stop pretending that you'll be happy with a City win. You want United to win. Don't lie to me.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.